This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Well, I have somebody entirely new for this next hour on Church and Culture, Dr. Amina Milonik, who has a doctorate from the University of Buffalo in comparative literature. She's originally from Bosnia, a survivor of the Bosnian War and the refugee camps of its aftermath. She immigrated to the United States in 1995 and became an American citizen in 2003. And she hasn't wasted any time getting published. She's written many, many articles and columns in magazines and journals, including the Claremont Review, the venerable University Bookman, whom my great aunt used to fund, by the way, in part, the New Criterion and the New English Review. Amina, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you so much, Jill. Thank you for having me.
And a lot of what you've written about is the movies, film, cinema. And
yes,
that's why I've asked you to come on the show today. And what we want to talk to is our listeners about is why films are a genuine art form that ought to be taken seriously.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and I've been writing about movies for a while now, but I've been a movie goer, to use Walker Percy's book title, for as long as I can remember. You know, I probably started watching movies as early as 6 or 7 years old, especially with my dad, and that the love of movies just continued. So I definitely take it very seriously, and we need to raise the standards for sure in talking about them and in making them, I think.
Can you just say a bit about your first experience of movies? I mean, what films really stick out from those times you watched films with your dad?
Strangely enough, one that always keeps coming back to me is Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey. And we watched that numerous times together, my dad and I. And I remember I was frightened of certain scenes, too, when I was, you know, much younger. But then, obviously, as I have seen it many times since then, and I think that's the, you know, first it started with a kind of visceral experience of watching a movie when you're young, and then as you're getting older, you're able to kind of peel the layers of the meaning in the film, something you really couldn't even see when you were much younger. But I think it certainly stands to the, you know, testament of the film.
It was a 1968 film.
Right.
And as I rewatched it a couple of times getting ready to write my book, my new book that has a chapter on film, I was just amazed that it seemed absolutely contemporary to me.
Absolutely. I mean, the subject matter is philosophical, right? It's theological. It's
right.
It's political, you know. And I think that, and without really, Kubrick has this wonderful way of not, you know, slamming you with images, right? But rather, you know, he shows aesthetically what he wants to, you know, what he wants to show. But at the same time, you're taken into this universe that's a little bit odd, a little bit perverse, a little bit great, you know, all of these things that are kind of put together in what humanity really is in the end.
Well, this issue of whether cinema is a serious art form, of course, you know, it goes back a ways, but it keeps popping up. For example, in the response to Martin Scorsese's recent film, The Silence, based upon the great novel by Shashuka Indo, mm-hmm, about the Jesuit priest who were attempting to evangelize in Japan. He was moved to write an article for the Times Literary Supplement in response to a review on the Times Literary Supplement about his movie, where someone took exception to again, the status of film as an art form. What was his basic response?
What was that? Can you say that again?
What was Scorsese's basic response to the critic?
Right. I think what was interesting about that is that he ended up talking about movies. He didn't use this word metaphysical, I don't think, in that article. But I think he ended up talking about movies as cinema and as a metaphysical experience, and not only raising the standards of cinema, which he wasn't even really concentrating on that as much, but more like on this encounter between a director and the image that he's trying to produce, and I think by implication an encounter between the viewer and the image, and ultimately the director, right? Because everybody's kind of in an interesting dialogue. And I think what Scorsese is saying implicitly in this sense is that at the core of it is this human encounter. And when I say encounter, I mean something that is much deeper than just, bumping into somebody, right? We're talking about encounter in the fullness of who you are as a human being. So you're kind of invited. I think he invites us to experience those images in such a way, in the fullness of our being. I think that's why he's saying that cinema is art, that it isn't just, you know, pure pleasure, although it can be that, and you certainly talked about that in your book as well.
Well, you know, it seems to me that as an art form, it's one of the toughest to pull off because you've got so many different elements that a director has to have control over, you know, beginning with the screenplay, the casting, the art direction, the music, the the actual filming, the cutting, the editing. It seems to me that, and he compares it to writing music, to how a listener experiences the way a symphony, for example, is put together by a composer. Why do you think that even as, you know, after all these years, that anyone would really question the status of film the way this critic, Martin Scorsese, did? I mean, why is this still an issue at all?
You mean whether or why cinema is art form?
Yes.
Well, you know, I really think that lately, in any case, I haven't seen many movies that have been made that have a particularly human message. So in my opinion, I think ideology has taken over, political ideology, and as a result, cinema itself has kind of taken a backseat. So any attempt at making a film that tells a human story, a deeply human story, that I think all of us can either relate to or at least aesthetically evaluate has been lost because of the unfortunate
politicization.
Yes. Ideology, I think, ultimately is at fault, and of course, those who proponents of ideology who would rather tell us something political rather than present us with images. Now, there's a difference, of course, between morality and ideology and even morality and politics. So it's different if any sort of aesthetic expression has also a moral expression. But that's not, I think, what the case is today.
I'm talking with Dr. Amina Milonic about movies. She and husband and child live up near Buffalo, where she got her doctorate in comparative literature. But it seems to me that, you know, side by side with the issue of politicization is the issue of trivialization. And I'm thinking of the Marvel series of films, which, as far as, you know, to me, they only exist to make money. I mean, they only exist to open to, you know, $300 million or $400 million. And they are... they're like bonbons. I mean, they're as about nutritious as a Krispy Kreme donut. In a sense, if you want to talk about feeding the mind or feeding the spirit, and you talk about, and I agree with you completely, that film, like any art form, addresses the human condition, and the more deeply, perceptively it addresses it, the greater it is. And I think all art meets there, you know, human journey, human life, you know, how we live. But these things are just total fantasies, and you walk out of the film and you take nothing away except your stomach may be filled with popcorn.
Right, exactly. And I'm so glad you used that metaphor, right, of feeding the mind. I think that there is nothing wrong with watching a movie, you know, an action movie, and I certainly do it. These are, you know, sort of sheer pleasure kind of experiences. But I think with, like, the superhero movies that Scorsese was criticizing, it was an offhand remark, really. I think it was just in an interview, but everybody made such a huge, you know, huge deal about it. I think really what, and you have you know, alluded to this, it really has to do with human questions. Are the questions of who we are as human beings, who we are to one another, what is our relationship to God? Do we not have any relationship to God? I think these are kind of perennial questions, right? Or to use, you know, that phrase, permanent things, right? Are these questions that we're going to keep coming back to all the time? Like, you know, Ingmar Bergman was his films, they're absolutely beautiful and some of the most philosophical films in cinema.
Absolutely so, penetrating films.
So I think that it's the lack of these questions. And I think really, you know, I have written about all kinds of movies, not just kind of proper cinema, but I've written about B-movies and, again, these kind of sheer pleasure movies. And I don't see anything wrong with them, but I think that the standard itself has to be raised. And you can't treat pop art the same way as high art, if I can make that distinction.
Well, please do, and make it many times. And I think that what we're looking at here, Amina, is an attitude toward film, which is largely, this is entertainment, this is where I go to get away from it all, this is where I go to not think about my problems or romance my girlfriend or whatever. And it's sort of like the same thing as picking up a book like a romance novel versus picking up a novel by Balzac. Two completely different attitudes toward the experience.
Completely, and I think that's really it. You know, it has to do also with what kind of disposition we bring into it, and what kind of expectation we bring into it. So, I think if I do see a superhero movie, which I really don't, I have actually tried, but somehow I can't connect to it. But even if I, let's say, try to do that, I'm not going to expect to be nourished in any way, nor am I going to leave the theater thinking about the meaning of life. You know, I'll
probably... Well, you know, the only part of superhero movies that I really enjoy is the humor. And sometimes there is quite good moments of humor. But the humor represents them making fun of the movie they're in.
Right.
And saying, hey, we know this means nothing, that it's a joke, but here we are, and we hope you enjoy it.
Right. So then you wonder what the effort of all of this is. And
money.
Right.
I mean, look, before superhero movies, we had, remakes of major movies. You remember the remake of Hitchcock's Psycho and so forth, the disaster. But then you started having these, what do you call it, Jurassic Park, Jurassic mm-hmm. Park 2, 3, and all the Indiana Jones movies, the Star Wars movies. The only one I ever liked was the first one. So it's this branding in order to have a guaranteed audience the first weekend a movie is released.
And there's a certainty, right? So then, you know, an artist then doesn't really suffer for his art in that sense, because you're driven by something entirely different. Let's say studio gives you enough money so you don't have to worry about any of that. And I think I think that was really Scorsese's point about that as well. And he has spoken against kind of democratization of movies. Not in any sort of elitist way, but more from a kind of vantage point of a director who is really suffering through this in order to create this beautiful work of art.
Well, you know, let's talk about Scorsese for a second. He really is someone who not just makes great films, but has helped to restore great films. He's helped to get attention shown to films that are outside of the normal distribution circles, foreign films and so forth. He speaks very, very eloquently about the greatness of the art form. And, you know, even though I didn't care for his movie about Christ, Last Temptation of Christ, I didn't care for it. But that may be as much as the fault of Katzenzakis than it is Scorsese. I thought Silence was good, but never rose to the greatness that I hoped for. And because it became too cynical, and being a fan of the Endo novel, I didn't find that in the Endo novel. What did you think of Silence?
I've seen the film, and I've started to read the book, and I went halfway through the book, and it was very demanding, and at that point, I really couldn't continue it. I think I was doing other things. But I think that, you know, Scorsese, so I can't really compare them completely. But I think that, you know, for a lot of the times with him, it's almost more valuable when he speaks about movies than even when he makes them, because I think he really expresses that love very, you know, very beautifully. And he has said also about, you know, about the suffering of the artist when he said, we used to, as directors, he said, we used to bleed. And he said, not only metaphorically speaking, but literally, when you were in the cutting room, you would be cutting the celluloid and you'd have, you know, you'd scratch yourself and your fingers would be bloody. So I think that he really is trying in whatever ways possible to restore cinema to its rightful.
But let's remember, I mean, the movies. I'm looking at a list: Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, After Hours, The Age of Innocence, which was, I think, a great movie. Let me keep looking here. The Wolf of Wall Street. Not sure about that. Irishman is coming out, which is supposed to be fantastic. The King of Comedy with Jerry Lewis, which is really an underappreciated classic, I think. Gangs of New York, it's hard to watch, but I think is good. Casino is, I think, another masterpiece. The remake of Cape Fear is one of the few successful remakes of a classic movie. And then Goodfellas. There's a lot of very fine filmmaking there that makes Scorsese rank with the greatest of filmmakers, I think.
I think so, too. I agree with you. I mean, The Aviator also, and he always makes these very long movies, right? And he doesn't sacrifice, you know, he's not trying to put it in this time constraint just so we can swallow it easily or something. So I think he is a demanding filmmaker, but that's, you know, that's what you get. I mean, you know, otherwise, what is the point, I guess, if you don't challenge yourself, if you don't ask challenging questions, and if you don't examine your life through these images.
So, but let's put ourselves in the skin of the sort of average moviegoer. Now, that's really hard to do because there probably isn't one. But, for example, my wife and I recently went to see Joker just a few days ago. Hmm. Now, we knew that was not going to be, quote-unquote, entertaining. We knew that it was a dark and difficult film, but we went because we admire Joaquin Phoenix very much as an actor and wanted to see what he would do with that. And I think a lot of people went to that movie because it's the prequel to Batman. Frankly, I didn't know it was the prequel to Batman until my wife told me afterward. Hmm. So I was watching it as, you know, a standalone film. And we went to it, even though we know we'd be challenged and maybe put off, We knew it wasn't going to be a Marvel pastime movie. Now, my question to you is, what percentage of the movie-going public will do that?
You mean go there without thinking it's a Marvel movie, or...
Or not thinking it's just going to be an entertainment. It's really going to be demanding.
Oh, I see. I've been reading reviews of it, so it seems that, well, at least reviewers thought it wasn't going to be any, that it would be a demanding film. But I would think, given the previews, do you think that maybe people would understand what they're getting into? I mean, it's very difficult for me to...
Well, the way it was promoted was really not as a serious film about a very damaged child who... as he grew up, became savage and really broken, and took on a persona that became the hit of New York City, that everybody wanted to be the Joker, at least everybody who wasn't in power or wealth. Now, what disturbed me about the film is not so much the Joker, played by Phoenix, because he was horribly damaged as a child. What bothered me is that the citizenry of the city, which was presented as New York City, not as Gotham City, began wearing Joker masks immediately. And I was very, very, it just got under my skin completely.
So it was really more this kind of collectivism.
Right, yeah. I mean, is that what's going on out there? And I just don't know it.
I think that people do tend to do that, right? They tend to go what everyone else is doing. So to be a lone voice, either of reason or, in this case, with the Joker of insanity, I think it's very, very difficult. I'm not saying they're the same, obviously, but...
But let me ask you a personal question, Amina.
Yes.
How much does your experience growing up in Bosnia, going through the war... The camp. How much does that color your view of how you look at American culture and its arts, its films?
Well, I love America. You know, I've always loved this country even before I came here. And one of the things that really made me move toward America even more so was movies. That was really kind of my entrance into this country. Really,
the movies brought you here.
Yeah, it was the entrance, metaphysical entrance, right, into what America is. Now, of course, doesn't mean that every single time it was exactly that. You know, a lot of the movies are pure fantasies. So then you are faced with a kind of reality once I came here, certainly. Not that I thought, you know, that everything that was happening in movies is happening here. But I think there's like with most immigrants, there's a kind of awakening once they make it to the soil of the United States, because it is such a beautiful and strange country at the same time.
Well, you and your family need to move to the South so you can really find out what America's like. I don't mean to insult upstate New Yorkers, but I've lived most regions of the country, and the American South is really... where the manners are, even though it's too darn hot. Let me ask you this question. We have just a minute or two left in this segment. What films for you have defined, sort of represented the American experience?
Before I came to America?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. Probably movies of the 80s as I was growing up. Which was really strange that they were available in, communist Yugoslavia, but go figure, somehow we got our hands on that. So that in itself was kind of...
Which films of the 80s?
You know, Back to the Future, Indiana Jones, you know, all of those kind of blockbuster movies, not really serious movies at all. More like kind of cultural representatives of the 80s American decadence, you know. So there was a kind of strange beauty in that as well, even though, you know, now I can reflect back and say it's just a blockbuster, right? But that's why there's a value in that, too, not the same value as a serious film. But
you know, we have to make a distinction. We can come back to this. between something like Spielberg's Indiana Jones and some of his other great films, there is a form of American movie that is not a bonbon. It may not be profound, but it's really well made in a category somewhere between the art film and the pop film. I don't know what word to use. When we come back from brief break, we'll look for one. So it's sort of the analog would be the classic American songbook of Cole Porter and Jerome Kern. These films fit there. And so I'll be back with Amina Milonic after this break.
The next third Sunday concert of the season at Old St. Mary's in Detroit in Greektown will be on October 20th at 2:30 p.m. and will feature a program entitled Music of the Italian Baroque. It will be performed by the ensemble Lanvincioni, using Baroque-style instruments and featuring concerti by Scarlatti, Battista, and Vivaldi. There is free and guarded parking and no admission charge. Please see oldstmarysdetroit.com. That's oldstmarysdetroit.com.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Stress is contagious, even for toddlers. A new study by the University of Cambridge found that even after controlling for temperament, the more stressed moms and dads felt, the more their toddlers tended to be clingy, tantruming, whiny, and defiant. In general, kids are terrific emotional barometers. Little ones especially are always taking their emotional cues from us, even when we think we're keeping it to ourselves. Parents' stress plays out in our facial expressions, our posture, our attitudes, and our ability to pay attention, all things our kids attend to closely. When our kids notice us feeling stressed, it makes them feel unsafe and causes them to act out. If your little one seems off, a good first step is asking yourself how you're managing your own stress level. An ounce of self-care can sometimes be worth a pound of discipline. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
How do you keep the family Catholic? Hi, this is Peggy Stanton. Join me for great insights from an expert and a father of nine, Dr. Ryan Hanning, as we discuss the theology of the family. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
With Dr. Amina Milonic, who lives with her husband and child outside Buffalo, where she got her doctorate in Comp Lit, talking about the movies as an art form and a place in American culture. And Amina just said there, you know, that her love affair, so to speak, with America began by watching movies. Amina, you mentioned the 80s movies. Were there any others that attracted you to America?
Yes, definitely. I was watching a lot of 30s and 40s movies, a lot of film noir. I mean, Humphrey Bogart, right, and Laura McCall. There was just such an air of mystery and really mystique, too, about those movies, which are not aesthetically, obviously, the same thing as you would find in Bosnian films or in any kind of Slavic, Eastern European cinema, which is very dark, a very dark kind of humor. Sometimes even cynical. In America, you know, when I was watching the movies about America, there's a kind of expansiveness to it. I watched a lot of big productions, too, like Cecil B. DeMille and all those huge, Technicolor American productions. And I think it was the expansiveness and the absolute outwardness that was very attractive to me. It wasn't that European interiority. Europeans kind of tend to go inward and Americans go outward. There's a kind of exploration in the American spirit in this kind of...
Yeah, it's both its strength and its weakness.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And that's why, as we were talking about Marvel, I wanted to make a distinction between that set of films and these great films of greatness made by Steven Spielberg and others who have taken the American film and really extended it, you know, made it contemporary and pioneered, you know, the new directions of it from the films you describe. And I'm not sure, the best I can come up with, as I said, is a kind of analog to, you know, the songs of Cole Porter or Jerome Kern, George Gershwin, and so forth. They have greatness inside of American popular culture, which is not just, you know, it's not just silly and not just entertainment. It's it can be deeply, deeply moving. You know, but I'm, as we were talking, Amina, I was thinking of American screwball comedy, which is so unique to America, and it just it to me, it represented the filmmaker's attempt to tell saucy stories, so to speak, and not get busted by the censor. And it forced them to be more creative than if there had been no censor at all.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, especially if you, I mean, in pre-code era, I mean, we're talking now silent movies, of course, and maybe even some talkies after or before the code. You know, you could almost do anything you wanted to, except if society is kind of regulating some of the norms. But I think after the code and the censoring came along, in many ways, I think it made people more creative, like you said.
I spent a year or so exploring pre-code movies, thinking they were going to be, you know, kind of exotic and so forth. And they're not. They're very formulaic.
Mm-hmm.
And they're titillation of the kind of most boring kind, very predictable. I mean, there are some wonderful actors and actresses that came out, like Joan Blondell, and Joan Crawford and so forth, who are, but they're much better in this screwball era, when they had much better scripts, much more interesting narratives. I mean, Philadelphia Story,
mm-hmm.
And what's how to? Oh, come on, with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn trying to find the cougar. Bringing a Baby is my favorite comedy of all time.
Yes. Yeah, there was a kind of innuendo there that was always, right? That's always sort of hovering, but it's not really completely there. And the script kind of moved fast. It was almost play-like. You had to kind of think fast in order to understand what they were saying. At least that's my experience.
Well, I think you're right. And what's the point we're trying to make? We're trying to make the point that American film is a serious art form which has many different variations. You can't just, you know, have one big distinction between serious films and pure entertainment films. What it seems to me with the, and tell me if I'm out on a limb here, it seems to me what the master American directors have done is taking a medium that began in silent era, with some exceptions, to be merely an entertainment, created something lasting out of it.
I think so, too. I agree with you, and I think it has to do with this expansiveness, because I think that is in a natural American spirit. And whatever form I think that takes aesthetically, that is up to every director. But I do think that even in movies, you know, like Indiana Jones, in which you can find numerous mistakes, it can be frustrating sometimes, actually. You still kind of feel for this character, right? For Harrison Ford, for this you know, funny and action-packed kind of guy, right? But you somehow feel like you can relate in a strange way, you know, or maybe you want to be him or something like that.
Well, there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, And I don't mean to dismiss silent era. I mean, I'm a great admirer of silent era. I mean, Chaplin remains absolutely contemporaneous, as does Lloyd. Buster Keaton. I mean, I remember the first time I watched his major movies, I couldn't believe what I saw and the kind of things he did on screen. You know, stand there while this entire house falls down around him.
It really is amazing. And I think to go back to what you said about the sort of pushing of the moral boundaries, I think that's part of the silent film era. But you can even see even between... that was kind of mixed up with German expressionism, right? A lot of the
right.
kind of made it to America. But there are films that are a little bit more... deeper, let's say Pandora's Box with Louise Brooks.
My favorite silent movie of
Absolutely.
All time.
I think that's my favorite movie of all time, perhaps.
That is just a stunning movie with Louise Brooks.
Metropolis, of course, which is just, you could just watch it and watch it. And I think that, but then you have A Fool There Was with Teta Bara, and that's a kind of a, you know, it's really just about pushing the moral boundaries, right? Because, you know, she's showing ankle or something like that.
Right. And you know, she wasn't all that attractive in the first place. But, you know, if you go to Pabst's Pandora's Box, which you mentioned, that is such a probing and almost frightening exploration of character and manipulation, moral weakness, the consequences of it. It sort of hits you like the Joker does at the very end.
Hmm.
When Jack the Ripper, you know, she picks up Jack the Ripper by mistake, takes him home.
Right.
So you had, and you take the movie M with Peter Lorre, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that, tell me that who that was directed by?
That was Lang, right? That was Fritz Lang.
Fritz Lang.
Yeah, right.
And that, you know, those scenes where he is taken before the crowd that wants to hang him. It is, you know, power packed, but yet any words you see are, you know, on placards. And you can pick out a dozen silent films and stand them side by side with any sound film.
I completely agree with you, and I think also there's something about this sort of almost like internal horror that you're feeling. It's not a horror movie, but it's this, you know, especially with Pandora's Box, it's her constant foolish eros, if you will.
Well, it's her seduction. I mean, she's seducing everybody.
She is, and but at the same time, it's almost as if she's not even aware of what she's doing.
Yeah.
Her love or her erotic expression is so overwhelming that she doesn't even know what to do with it anymore.
And, of course, the viewer is taken in, too, because even though the viewer knows what's going on, you can't take your eyes off her.
Right, exactly.
So here we are. We're discussing already. We're kind of making distinctions between great silence, the comedic silence of Chaplin, Lloyd, Keaton, the dramatic silence, especially those coming from Germany, although Frank Borsigi made, you know, some of the greatest before the sound era came in. And we've talked about pre-code. We talk about the coming out of the pre-code into the code area, which created screwball comedy. So we've already established a kind of chronology, and we're headed toward a kind of a methodology of how to talk about film, American film, and how to distinguish between them and to notice why they may have developed in this direction and not another.
Yes, and I really think that's really what is important when it comes to looking at these films. I think it's understanding what's the difference between them, what the similarity is between them. And whenever I would actually teach about this, because I've been a teacher for a while, and I would tell my students, it's okay if you want to watch a B-movie or a horror movie, and they can be quite good. But you have to understand that there's a huge difference between that and, let's say, Ingmar Bergman, right? Which takes you into that sort of human condition that we talked about. I do think there is value in B movies or in any, even in these Marvel movies. But I think it has to do with talking about a particular moment in culture, in cultural history. So
right.
You won't really be talking about the movies themselves necessarily, because the movie may not stand the test of time. But whatever was happening in the culture at the time, the movie can be kind of you know what I'm saying here?
Yes, exactly.
Right. But
I was also, as you were talking, I want you to talk a little bit about the American reluctance to watch films in a foreign language. This really gets to me when I, recommend the great film by Bergman, Autumn Sonata, which I write about at length in my book, How to Keep from Losing Your Mind, or, you know, the great Kielkowski movies, you know, the Cathar Brisson, you know, the Catholic, great Catholic filmmakers, the Taviani brothers, De Sica. I mean, we could go on. But what do you think that reluctance is breaking down at all?
You mean, are people really, they're still kind of maintaining they don't want to watch European films? Or
any films in a foreign language.
You know, it's sort of like, oh, does it have subtitles? I don't want to read it.
Right. Is that breaking down at all?
I don't know. I actually think it's getting worse, unfortunately. I'm not very hopeful. Maybe I should be a little bit more, but I think you always have this pull between high art and low art. I think that will exist at all times. The problem is whatever low art is happening and being created right now is not even that much worthy of watching. I think that's my problem, actually, that even popcorn movies are not that good. And I think the audience, unfortunately, gravitates towards the least work they have to do in order to be simply entertained. I do think that something like Netflix or any of those streaming services, having introduced a kind of binging, right, the binging of TV, has made matters worse in giving attention, proper attention to something.
But, let me try this on you. If you search on Netflix or Hulu or Prime, you can find all kinds of foreign films.
That's correct.
Which 10 years ago you couldn't find, you know. And also you have specialized streaming like the Criterion Collection.
Right.
Or MUBI Movie, which the classics, including your Eastern European classics, are available. So at least they're accessible. When I started watching movies trying to watch foreign movies 30 years ago, a lot of them you just couldn't find.
So the availability was less.
Well, it was less by 100 times. Because when you went into your local video rental place, the foreign film section was like one small rack.
Right.
And that was it.
So, you're probably right. There is more availability, but I don't think that, I'm not sure whether people are really going towards that. But then again, I think that the audience for that will always be smaller, unfortunately. I mean, would you think that, or am I wrong?
Well, no, I think, it's going to be smaller. It's kind of like classical music. Classical music is now more accessible than ever. You can watch almost any significant piece of music on YouTube performed live. Opera as well. Does that mean more people will become fans, become adherents, and so forth? It certainly makes that a possibility, Amina. It makes it a possibility.
Right. Yeah, and I think there is hope in that, the fact that it is more available. I really shouldn't be so hopeless about it.
I believe
you're right. I know for my students, you know, a lot of the times I would bring a lot of films to their attention, a lot of books that they haven't really heard of, and certainly in education they're not going to hear about great books, but that's another topic.
Well, tell our listeners about Eastern European cinema. What is it they must see before they die?
Oh, my goodness. That's a tough question. Well, certainly Kieslowski, you know, the Color Trilogy.
The Decalogue and the Color Trilogy.
The Decalogue, of course.
He's Polish.
He's Polish, that's right. Any Czech cinema is really... Czech cinema has black humor, and I think...
Well, give us the names of directors and movies.
Oh, my goodness, I'm trying to think now. Jiří Menzel is one.
What about Miloš Forman?
Miloš Forman, but he made American movies, though.
Yeah, he made Amadeus, but he made The Fireman's Ball first.
Yeah, that's true. And, of course, there's a lot of Bosnian movies, or movies that came out of former Yugoslavia, and... one of them certainly is Kusturica, who made Underground. That's one of the films.
Yeah, I've seen that. That's a wonderful movie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's a very much a controversial figure politically, but because.
Well, you mentioned Vlasil, who did Marketa Lazarnova.
Marketa Lazarova, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Then there's a lot of new wave, the Czech new wave cinema. I'm trying to think of the titles now. I can't remember, but I think that the one thing to certainly, you know, keep in mind is that Slavic cinema really is, if I can, you know, put it in that category, is a different kind of experience.
Russian cinema under that?
I think that's a little bit different. Russians tend to be more interior, I think.
Well, not Eisenstein.
Okay, yeah. It's certainly Tarkovsky, though.
Yeah, Tarkovsky is one of the great. He's still alive, I believe. No, he's not.
No, he's not. I think he
just died. But I watched his Andrei Rublev.
Rublev, yeah.
I was stunned when I just couldn't believe how wonderful, how powerful a movie that was. Andrei Rublev.
I think that Russian cinema is more, again, more interior. It's actually in that sense similar to movies of Bergman. But I think any other Eastern European, Southeastern European films are funny in a very dark way. So we have sort of accepted our fate as you know, living in dark times. And I think a lot of the times these filmmakers laugh at it, and so that's where the black humor comes from. But it's a definitely different kind of mindset from America.
Is it still that way?
Yes. You mean the movies, the Slavic movies?
Yeah.
Yes.
And they're still in a kind of post-traumatic syndrome stage.
Oh, absolutely. I think war is certainly, Bosnia war is still a subject matter, even if it's just peripheral. I mean, how can it not be, you know? It's very much still alive for everybody.
And with that, the prejudices, hostilities, and suspicions.
Right, exactly.
Now, so you now have been in the United States since 1995?
96.
Makes you what? How long have you been here?
Since 96. So.
Yeah, how many years? So.
How many years is that?
23.
I'm not good at
right?
math. 23.
Yeah. And has America been, has it lived up to what you saw it to be in the movies?
I think that's really impossible to answer because it's a different kind of America. There's actually more of America that I have experienced outside of the movies. That is, there is much more to the American mind and the American heart than movies, certainly the ones that I was watching at the time, could ever possibly show. And, you know, when I first came here, it was absolute culture shock in many ways. I've discovered the nobleness, I guess, and of the American spirit, which I didn't necessarily see in the movies.
That's nice. What do you mean by nobility?
Nobility, right? Nobleness, nobility. I mean in the sense that there's always something hopeful about being American. And I think it, which is completely really different from talking about darkness, Eastern European darkness, it really is very much different. And sometimes it can be naivete, you know, also of the American character. But I have great love of America. I obviously became an American citizen. And if I have to, you know, simply say that statement, is that I'm would like to defend it, right? I would like to defend that American spirit.
Okay, I'm really going to put you on the spot.
Okay.
Can you think of a film or films that contains this nobility, mm-hmm. that portrays it?
Oh, my goodness, that is so hard. You know what? Recently, I have rewatched again John Cassavetes, A Woman Under the Influence.
Yes.
And it's a deeply interior film, but I think it has that American spirit of the people, of who the people are, of non-elitism, of, do you know what I'm trying to say?
Like a solidarity, as it were?
Yeah, solidarity, but also this kind of, this sort of constant thrust to be a better person and to succeed in one way or the other, even despite the struggles. I think that's really what is deeply American.
Now, John Cassavetes is probably best known to our listeners as an actor, a very good one.
Right.
Yet he's really one of the most distinctive American directors, isn't he?
Absolutely. He's very demanding. My goodness. You certainly talk about no popcorn movie. I mean, anything you see by him is very, very demanding, which makes him a very strange American director, right? You would think that. But no, I think that there is that sort of openness and spirit that's distinctly American that you see in his movies.
I think of him in The Dirty Dozen, and I just laugh.
He
plays a sort of Looney Tunes guy. I mean by that, the craft crazy guy.
Right.
But he turns out to be heroic, you know.
Oh, okay.
And what are Cassavetes' other films worth watching?
Little Shadows, certainly that's one of his earliest ones. Killing of the Chinese Bookie, that's an interesting movie. That's with Ben Gazzara. And I think that
another great actor.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. And I think that in most of his movies, really, I think that Cassavetes was successful in exploring American masculinity and sort of the interplay between men and women. He really wanted to understand that interiority. But I think it is distinctly aesthetically and psychologically American.
His films. For those of us who have watched a lot of European cinema, his films come across as European films, but American.
Yeah. Maybe.
Especially French. They really come across as French.
Maybe a little like Truffaut, right?
Yeah.
A little bit similar to that. They do, but I can't really... Maybe I'm having trouble explaining it, or 'cause I think his films are... very profound in looking at this distinctly American interiority, I guess.
Yeah, he's searching for the raw reality that most movies just skim over.
Right, right, exactly. He wants to sort of, he wants to see people leave the theater and go, I can't believe he did that. I can't believe he's making me think, why is he doing this? My life is perfect.
Well, Dr. Amina Malonic, you've been a great guest, and I really appreciate your comments about coming to America and finding a nobility. What a great theme that I think you should explore further in your writing. I don't know if you already have, but we'll certainly come back on this show and talk more about it. And thank you for being a guest on Church and Culture.
Thank you for inviting me, Neil. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
I look forward to having you back sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And to all your listening, I'll be back next week on this day at this time.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.